This is the Farming for a Better Climate podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Farming for a Better Climate podcast. My name is Seamus Murphy and I'm joined again by Robert Ramsey. How's all in Ayrshire, Robert?
Yeah, good. It's Friday and it feels like we've made it through a week in the run-up to PSF deadlines and SAGS deadlines and things. It's been quite a busy spell for us. So, all good, all busy, but certainly looking forward to the weekend.
And we've been, in the last few podcasts, we've been hearing a lot about how different sectors have been impacted by the multi-crisis that have kind of affected agriculture in the world in the last 12 months. We're not far off the 12 months from the invasion of Ukraine, the year anniversary of that. How are things going in general in the wider industry in that regard at the moment?
So it's pretty interesting at the moment. So this time last year, it was in proper crisis. We didn't know what was coming next. We had, as if the cost of living thing wasn't enough, the Ukraine thing kicked off and really put the cat among the pigeons. Probably things have settled down to, we keep hearing about a new normal and hearing about, this is how it's going to be. And I think every sector probably has settled a good bit. Those that have been struggling have improved and those that have been booming have been reined in a wee bit. But I think across the board, farming's doing reasonably well. We've got plenty things we could, individual things we can complain about and certainly the areas that we need to improve, but on the whole I think things are going reasonably well, and that would figure given that historically farming has always performed very well in economically difficult times. Farming tends to do well, so farming performs well in a recession, and although we're not officially in a recession, we are in a difficult financial position. So farming, certainly the feeling in the industry across the board is a lot more settled this year than it was this time last year.
The challenges have been different as well across the different kind of sectors. That's what we've learned from listening to the different people we've been talking to. Today we're going to look at the arable sector, focusing on combinable crops. We've got our colleague Zach Riley here to help us to break down what the issues are and the challenges and how the arable sector is tackling these challenges. Welcome to the podcast, Zach.
Hi, Seamus. Thanks for having me on today.
No bother. I suppose the first question is what have you seen from your clients and in the kind of arable combinable crop sector, that what has been the impact of, say, the cost of living crisis, the energy crisis, these kind of things?
Quite a big question there. I'll try my best to break it down. So, as Robert said, this time last year, there was a huge amount of volatility. The cereal sector probably felt that quite acutely on the whole. Fertilizer being the major one. We had nitrogen sitting at £200-£250 a ton. It spiked to over £1,000 a ton. Off the back of the war in Ukraine, the grain price also saw a huge increase, again spiking over £300 a ton. Although there's still a lot of volatility, that's started to settle out a little bit. Fertilizer prices are back, particularly straights, and the wheat price unfortunately is back as well. Throw into the mix, we had modest but still important increases in ag chem costs. They were up 10% or 15% on the year before, and then there was obviously a massive increase in fuel costs. Red diesel went from somewhere in the 60 something pence a litre to over £1. Some people were having to buy springtime last year at £1.10, £1.15 a litre for red diesel. So I think on a whole for the sector, all that volatility, it put real stress on businesses' cash flows, and that was the main thing. I think the margin is still there for most people at the end of the day, but it was turning over huge sums of money to get to that position.
And how have people reacted to, I suppose it is such a wide kind of area that is important on a farm has been affected there, but say focusing maybe in on just fertilizer and the cost of fertilizer, which is a big expense, how have farmers reacted to that? What kind of things have farmers been doing to try and temper those costs?
I think it's really focused people's minds on what fertilizer they're using and why they're using it. You know, when it was cheap, it was easier to put it on at a rate that's always been put on. So we've certainly seen a huge increase in people asking more specific questions about fertilizer, preparing nutrient budgets. That's gone hand in hand with the Preparing for Sustainable Farming soil sampling grant. So we've had a big increase in the number of soil samples coming to us, and the nutrient budget has been on the back of that. I would say last year there was a number of farmers that took a P&K holiday, and they reduced the P&K applied to combinable crops, either by a proportion, so say half of the P&K that they might usually put on, or in some cases people who are sitting on high indices in the soil just didn't put any P&K on at all, just to try and save it. So looking forward to this season, I think that's something that's going to need to be addressed. There was some big crops last year, which was great to see. It was a really good harvest year, certainly on the east here. But that's ultimately resulted in the removal of an awful lot of P&K off the back of people taking a holiday and not applying it in the spring. So there could be a bit of catching up to do regarding fertiliser.
And I think, that issue crosses all sectors. Last year for the most part was an amazing growth year, whether you're growing grass or barley or whatever. Yields were really good, inputs were generally pulled back, as you see, Zach, and we probably all did a bit of mining last year. I think another interesting thing to, certainly in the west, so Zach, you're sitting in Forfar, a true arable area. I'm sitting in Ayr, which is obviously a mixed farming area, but we do have a number of specialist arable guys here too, who some are very into rotations and some are less keen and maybe more just barley. And the guys who have rotation or have multiple crops in a rotation, and probably the guys who have stock within that rotation as well, saw really good responses to slightly different ways, a slightly more traditional way of farming, less inputs, actually achieved quite good results, whereas those that were monoculture, push, they're very limited with what they can actually do when it comes to pulling things back.
Yeah, it's a good point. I think in this area we're pretty good for rotations. That's really driven by the potatoes, particularly seed potatoes, that are, they have to be grown a 1 in 7 years. So if nothing else, that breaks up the continuous barley. But most farms over here, they're geared up for growing a range of crops, and you can definitely see the benefit of the rotation in terms of weeds, pests, disease. What we don't have, though, is that abundance of manure or slurries. So we are quite reliant in this area on imported barked fertilizer. That's just part of farming in this area. Some farmers are lucky enough to have a intensive poultry unit or something nearby that they can use hen pen from, but on the whole, we're relying on bagged fertilizer, which makes the farms in this area even more vulnerable to big swings in fertilizer prices.
And then I suppose that if we just kind of go through those big areas, one of the next kind of big outlay, I would say, is probably in kind of fuel on an arable farm. So how have farmers dealt with that, or have you seen any kind of changes in the way farmers are operating to reduce that fuel use?
Well, I would say fuel's probably not one of the major spends. Right. In the grand scheme of things, if you're taking, say, a crop of wheat, for example, you're plant protection products in the whole could be £160 a hectare. Compare that against fuel costs, you could be 60 quid at old prices or 100 quid a hectare at new prices. So, you know, it's still a substantial cost. There was a massive increase there, but on the whole, there's bigger costs, fertilizer being the biggest, and then also your other fixed costs, machinery and labor, they tend to, you know, rank further up in terms of spend. Having said that, you know, nobody likes to see fuel prices double, and there was very little that most farms could do, to be quite honest. The price increases were happening mid-season. You know, farmers were needing their tank filled so that they could get on with spring work or you know, refill after the spring work was done ahead of harvest. So, yeah, I think what it has done, although there wasn't a lot of changes last season, I think it has focused a lot of growers' minds on just where that fuel use is going. There's some big invoices being paid to pay for red diesel, and you know, it's only when there's the sums of money at that extent going out the door that you start to really focus on where that money is going. And it's, I've had a lot of conversation with growers recently just to monitor fuel use, because I think most farms probably don't have that level of detail. You know, how many litres is it costing them, a plough or combine? Yeah. And the machinery now, it's the information's all there. It's just looking at it and analysing it and seeing if you can make a reduction off the back of it.
Yeah, it's knowing what to do with it, isn't it, really? That's the knowing what to do with that information and see if you can actually reduce that cost.
Yeah, I mean, the other side for the fuel use is that we had a really good harvest. It was very dry. A lot of people were combining grain and putting it straight in the shed, and they weren't having to dry it. So we were quite fortunate in that there was very little fuel used for drying last year. You know, if we get a wet harvest this year and the fuel price stays up where it is now, I think that would be a very different situation.
I was going to say as well, we had ideal drilling conditions in this part of the world too, that we, you know, ground was easy worked, and certainly those who went for a reduced tillage approach and things, that's a really good entry for what they were doing with plenty of moisture in the spring for establishment. You know, it was actually like the perfect, you know, if the price had been right, the rest of the year was perfect. So I think the fuel story would have been much, much more relevant had it been a 2012 or a 2017 kind of harvest that was really, really tough going. You burn an awful lot more stuff when things aren't going in your favour.
And so, Zach, have you seen much of an increase in the kind of interest or demand for kind of renewables on farm?
I think there's a lot more interest for it, definitely, particularly in the potato sector where farms are running cold stores, putting panels on roofs. If they've not already done so, a lot of people are looking at these options. I think the difficulty is that the peak energy use for, say, a cold store, it's happening at a time where you wouldn't typically be producing that much electric through panels. So it's getting the two to tie up. You know, it's the farms that are storing into the summer that they would really get the benefit from that. Mm. Other than that, there are a number of farms that, you know, have invested in renewables historically, you know, whether that's panels or biomass boilers to run things like dryers and heat workshops. And they've obviously seen the benefit. As we were saying, it was a good harvest, so the benefit could have been a lot larger if it was a wet harvest, but still it's good to have that renewable energy source to fall back on.
Yeah. It's interesting to look at these businesses as well. Like there's a lot of people that are putting renewables on to help an enterprise, you know, to help that, Zach says, the potato cold store or the robotic dairy or whatever it is, the sectors that have got a heavy electricity use, there's panels on the roof, but there's also the guys who are doing things as a separate enterprise, you know, as an actual, we've got a big shed, we don't have a big electricity use, but we've got a three-phase grid connection and we can actually produce some stuff. So it's one to, I think, everyone should consider. I think there's plenty of people who shouldn't cover their whole steading in solar panels, but it's certainly the opportunity's there. Mm. And although the you know, the feed-in tariff and the RHI are gone. The economics of the whole situation at the moment are making the renewable thing quite attractive. What I would say is probably run a budget. If you're looking at a renewable system, get a third party to check it. So there's a lot of budgets going about from people who are actually selling you the panels. And basically, you know, you'll put them on and, you know, quite often you'll see they've got a 1 year payback and things, but the assumptions in there are pretty strong. So it's worth just taking a bit of advice, take a bit of time, and that advice doesn't have to come from us or paid advice. That could be talking about it in the pub, talking to other people who've done it and comparing notes and things about what's the actual payback period. Because there are some pretty ambitious salesman type budgets going about at the moment.
It's definitely something that could be built in to build up that kind of resilience to a business, definitely. And at the current prices, it seems worthwhile. But as you say, those prices may not be there forever, and things may kind of stabilize, and then it maybe becomes less attractive of a prospect. I'm gonna bring it back a little bit. Zach, you're heavily involved as a facilitator for the Soil Regenerative Agriculture Group. So we've kind of touched on, Robert, you mentioned minimum tillage, and we talked about kind of some of the arable farms that have incorporated livestock or are on mixed units already. How have you seen the people that are getting into regenerative agriculture, how have they fared through this crisis?
That's quite another big question. How have they fared? So the group we're working with, there's five predominantly arable farms. One of the farmers, he's got cattle in it, and another one's got potatoes as well, but they're mainly cereal based businesses. So I think they face the same challenges that conventional farms did, in the way that, you know, inputs shot up through the roof to a level that nobody could have predicted. And then there's also the uncertainty about how they were selling their outputs as well. You know, how were they marketing their wheat or their barley? So I don't think that type of system made them immune to the volatility. I think in some ways, though, that they were, you know, we've had two very dry seasons in this part of the country over the last 2 years. From what I've seen, I think that change in cultivation practice has made them more resilient for weather conditions, which reduce the volatility from a very dry spring. So it removes a bit of uncertainty there, simply because the soil starts to become a bit healthier, and therefore you can manage your water within the soil a little better. The change into a reduced till system, there is a bit of a fuel saving. But to be honest, the biggest thing that impacts the return that you can get from a cereal crop is the yield at the end of the day. Farmers considering this system, I would just say that you've got to consider that system and make sure that if you're going to save a few pounds establishing a crop a different way, through fuel and machinery, reduce fuel and machinery costs, that you've got to make sure that you can still achieve that yield at the end of the day. And that's what the group's really been focusing on. And although it's, you know, there's some really promising results, it's not a guaranteed way to save costs. It takes a lot of management input.
It's quite interesting. Just now we've kind of managed to get into a situation where we're in a situation where people are either regenerative or they're not, and that's quite wrong. You know, this is a spectrum. There's some obviously very extreme, very regen focused people. There's a lot of people that sit in the middle that aren't entirely sure what regen is, or don't like the term. In fact, there's probably the majority are looking at that thinking, questioning the regen term. But the principles of all the regen stuff, like at the moment, the cover crop story certainly has landed. I think there's an awful lot less winter stubbles at the moment. You know, most winter stubbles have something green growing in them, which I think is a massive positive story for for the sector, you know, that we've actually stepped up to the plate and engaged with, you know, the science, with the messaging we've been getting, and that's a major win for all involved, that we've done something pretty positive across the board, or pretty much across the board. Is that fair, Zach, that there's a lot more green covers in?
Yeah, I would say so. I think you've touched on some really key points. I think there are a lot of people who are in the middle. You know, they wouldn't class themselves as regenerative, but they are still looking after their soils on farm. And I think that's one of the key things we've tried to convey from the group, is that actually most farms can tweak something here or there to become more sustainable or regenerative, if you want to phrase it that way. So although the group themselves, they're really pushing things forward, they're stretching their systems to see what they can do in a number of ways, whether it's tillage or nutrition or you know, overhauling rotations. Actually, I think there's probably take-home messages there for most farmers, and that's really what we tried to get across. We had a big open farm day at Back Both, one of the regen farmers. Farms 2 weeks ago, and we had a great turnout, and that was the key message we were trying to get across, is actually just try and look at your own system and your own farm and see if you can take some of these messages away to build a bit of resilience into your system. So I think that's quite important. I think in terms of cover cropping, I still think the driver in this area is to meet EFA. People are wanting that, you know, EFA green cover. And we got really good cover crops this year on the whole, because it was such an early harvest, and therefore the cover crops were able to be established so early. But it does vary year to year. I would say, from my point of view, the key thing is to not spend a fortune on cover crop seed. Cheap and cheerful, just get something growing. And I do think there's big benefits there.
Question I've got, I suppose, is all the green cover that I'm seeing growing, how much of it's actually sown green covers and how much of it's small grains off the back of a combine? There certainly was an amazing growthy back end, but I would totally agree. You know, it's not a, when there's demand for something, the price goes up. You know, you look at clover at the moment, the price of clover is through the roof because everyone is drilling clover into grass, which is a great, you know, that's a big win, and would encourage everyone to do that. But if you're putting a cover crop in the ground that's going to be there from October to February, I would agree, Zach. I think I'd rather see more acres done with cheaper seed than, you know, some super duper stuff sown at great expense.
Yeah, one of my kind of key recommendations for a cover crop is to meet the EFA requirement, you need a mix of two or more species. On that list of species is detailed in the guidance. You're allowed to put cereal in, whether it's oats or barley. So, you know, most farms end up with half a bag of seed. So they can mix that seed that's lying there in the corner of a shed, mix that in with some vetch or phacelia or something like that, and throw it in and get it growing. I think the establishment is something that we've focused on quite a lot through the group, and that early establishment, you know, in the last days of August and absolute latest is really important. But I think the other end is equally as important in how you manage that termination of the cover crop, and that's probably overlooked quite often. One, so that you don't get a green bridge, and then two, that you can actually manage that residue going into the next crop. So, you know, hopefully you get your cover crop in early, you get a really, you know, high biomass cover crop that's doing maximum the maximum benefit to your soil. But the other end, just, you know, do you need to terminate that with glyphosate? Can you graze it off? Does it actually need to be incorporated, you know, by ploughing it? And thinking the whole process through so that you don't actually end up creating a problem for yourself further down the line.
I think you hit on it, Zach, as well earlier, when it came to profit and yield, you know, the importance of a high or an optimized yield for the crop. That also fits in the carbon world too, is, you know, if we're going to be tilling soil, if we're going to be doing stuff, the more we can get, the more intensive we can be within reason, the better we are from a carbon perspective as well, on as an industry on the whole.
To kind of add to that, that like a lot of what we're talking about here will also have a positive impact on the farm carbon audit, whether that's in terms of the soil carbon kind of increasing that soil carbon, or reducing fertilizer requirements, following kind of cover cropping, those kind of things. So like it is does have that positive knock-on effects to the carbon audit and that the carbon the climate change story.
So Zach, if you listen to Gabe Brown and Kiss the Ground and all the real extreme regen people, one of the key principles is incorporating livestock into arable rotations. Is that something you are seeing more of, or more of an interest in, or are we still seeing a reduction in stock in your part of the world?
I'm not surprised you brought it back to livestock, to be honest, Robert. we'll let you off with that one. It's something we've been working with the group, actually. It's grazing winter cereals with sheep. So from an economic point of view, I really struggle to see a grass lay stacking up against the margin you can return from wheat, barley, or oilseed rape. So in terms of taking a field out of production and letting that field for grass for 2 or 3 years, I don't really see that as a viable option. So what we've done is we've looked at other ways to bring livestock in. So there's quite conventional ways, whether that's just importing manure from a nearby livestock unit, which there's plenty of people doing, and I think that works really well on the whole. You know, a straw for dung deal is quite a common thing in this area. Or there's actually getting the grazing livestock on the ground. And the key way to do that, I think, is bringing sheep off the hills over the winter months and putting them onto cereal crops. We've got a couple of years' trials now, both replicated trials at our own farms, and then also that's backed up with monitoring of commercial farms who've done split field trials for us. And we're not seeing any decrease in yield between grazed and ungrazed fields. And we've also monitored how the crop grows as well. And the only difference that we see is that the crop height would be 3 to 5 centimetres shorter in a grazed section than an ungrazed section. But in terms of tiller numbers or grains per ear or weed scores and disease scores, we're really not seeing any difference. So from my point of view, it's quite a win-win kind of situation, because it means you can bring livestock onto the farm. You get paid a small, you know, headage payment for having that grazing livestock unit on the farm. But it's allowing you to manage the winter crop growth. And I think that's really important, especially in your reduced till systems, is that if you can get your crops in earlier, and we've got people in this area putting wheat in as early as August, which would frighten a lot of people. The crop grows away in great conditions, and then you end up with this far too advanced cereal crop going into the winter that you can then manage through grazing it with sheep. So I think there's knock-on benefits by allowing you to, you know, cultivate or establish crops when the conditions are right, providing optimal crop growth conditions, and then you know, managing that through the winter. And we've got a few farms doing that. That started within the regen group, but I've had a lot of people contact me recently who are trying a field this year, and we're going to monitor them right through the year and scale this up. It's also great that we can then use those livestock to hop over onto the cover crops as well, and actually manage that cover crop growth you know, when we're allowed to in the new year. So the two can work together, where you can move livestock around from cereals onto cover crops and get that golden hoof back.
It's all really quite exciting. So where the industry, the pressure on the industry, the economic and environmental pressures mean that we need to be better than we've ever been, and diversity of enterprise seems to be a key driver, but the challenge of being the best and diverse is that you've got to be good at lots of things if you're doing it all yourself. But if we actually cooperate and work together, you can get a really good, efficient sheep system benefiting, or sheep farmer benefiting from what an arable farmer needs through the winter. You know, it's large scale diversity rather than everybody going back to having 20 different enterprises on one farm.
I think that's right. I think the cooperation's key. I don't see many farmers in this area suddenly going out and buying a flock of sheep, but they're willing for somebody else to put sheep on their ground. You've got your sheep farmers, you know, up the glens, looking for winter grazing. They're desperate for somewhere to put the sheep for a few months just to rest the grass at home, and cereals seem to fit that gap quite nicely.
That sounds really interesting. Sounds really exciting going forward, and looking forward then, Zach, into kind of 2023 and the harvest 2023. What's the outlook right now?
I would say the key concern in this area is that wheat price is back quite significantly. We're sitting around the £230 a ton. It's up and down a few pounds either way, but say about £230 a ton. Although the fertilizer price is back as well, a lot of arable farmers actually bought the fertilizer, you know, pre-Christmas, which has resulted in you know, quite high fertilizer prices. So this year is actually probably looking slightly tighter than last year, just because of the way the fluctuations in the market's gone. So I would say the key thing would be, from my point of view, is to make sure you know your cost of production, so that you can sell your grain, you know, at a profit. And then also just bear in mind the fertilizer policy from the last couple of years on your farm. We've spoken a little bit about P&K holidays. You know, bear that in mind if you have taken a P&K holiday, and consider that in the context of what your farm yielded last year, because I think a lot of people will be needing the fertilizer this year.
And I suppose there is probably a bit about what we kind of, when we spoke about regenerative practices, I suppose if someone is kind of interested or wants to learn more on that, there's loads of information on the Farming for a Better Climate website that the Soil Regenerative Ag Group has kind of, it's all kind of freely available, isn't it? It's all out there.
Yeah, there's loads on the website, and I'd also recommend people sign up to the newsletter, which takes the highlights from the project as well.
Yeah, and like we said all along, there is individual things within the regenerative agriculture that will fit on every farm, possibly, that, you know, every farm can do something that can to benefit from the stuff that is under the regenerative agriculture umbrella.
There's a lot of mistakes get made in the regen world. You know, we're trying to do things differently to what we've been used to doing it. Learning from other people's mistakes is a really, really good place to start. Is, you know, if we all go without any resources or without anything, there's a risk that we all go and make the same mistake. So there's a few things. You know, there are, I suppose there's groups of people, human beings, that are the reason that we don't still sit in a cave. And those regen guys that have been doing this for a while are those kind of trailblazing people. And like all these resources we've talked about, or even, you know, just having conversations with these positive, forward-thinking people is the way to make sure that your journey's a bit less bumpy than some of theirs have been.
Yeah. Great. I personally thought that you still lived in a cave, Robert, but
yeah. Nice. Good view.
Okay. Thanks, Zach and Robert, for joining today. For more information, please visit the Farming for a Better Climate website. There's also loads more information on the Farm Advisory Service website, and we'll be back with another podcast soon. Thanks for listening.